From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. This fall, 500,000 Bay Area Catholics get a new leader. Oakland Bishop Salvatore Cordiglione will now lead the Catholic Archdiocese that stretches from Marin to the South Bay. Bishop Cordiglione is known as an outspoken foe of gay marriage, who lent vigorous support to the Prop 8 campaign. But he's also known as a champion of immigrant rights and the DREAM Act, and worked in support of living wage campaigns. How well will the new archbishop fit his new flock? Where does the archbishop stand on issues ranging from the role of women in the church to rebuilding the priesthood? We'll find out next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Oakland Bishop the Reverend Salvatore Cordiglione becomes the new Archbishop for San Francisco officially this fall. An increasingly prominent figure within the church, he took a leadership role in the fight against gay marriage in California and was similarly outspoken in his opposition to the requirement to include contraception services in the new national health care law. If such stands sound out of sync with San Francisco's liberal sensibilities, that's only part of the bishop's record. He opposes the death penalty, for example. He supported President Obama's decision to let undocumented young people stay in this country without fear of deportation. And he's also worked in support of various living wage campaigns. He takes over leadership of a region that includes 500,000 Catholics at a time of many more churchly challenges as well, including a nationwide shortage of priests, the lingering fallout from the priest pedophile scandal, and a current fractious dispute with the organization that represents most American Catholic sisters. And Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
You have a lot on your plate.
Yes, it's a big job.
I want to begin by talking about the question of diversity kind of broadly writ in a way, because as I just mentioned, you have stands on a variety of social issues that many liberals might find contradictory. And I want to explore the common ground within those, starting with the question of immigration. You were a big supporter of the DREAM Act and very supportive of the president's decision to include or make sure that young undocumented could stay in this country. Why is that to you a religious issue?
It's a religious issue because it touches upon human dignity. So I always try to, well, thinking in union with my brother bishops, we're all in favor of this immigration reform. Anything that affirms human dignity, that will help keep families together. So many of these immigrants, their families are separated. A family tragedy happens. They can't go home without fear of not getting back in the country, without fear even for their lives because it's so dangerous to cross. They're people looking, they're looking for jobs. They're looking for opportunities to provide for their families. So to me, it's a matter of human dignity and the dignity of work and the dignity of trying to keep families together.
And of course, there's also, I would think, to some degree, a pragmatic question here for the church, because a lot of the increase in the church's population has to do with immigrant groups as well, correct?
Yes, many of the immigrants in this country do come from countries that are traditionally Catholic. So I suppose it gives us a special added concern. It's not that we wouldn't be concerned about justice for immigrants if they weren't coming from Catholic countries, but I suppose it gives us a special sensitivity to it.
And how does that link in then with the work that I know you did in San Diego in support of living wage campaigns? Is that again to you sort of this fundamental question of human dignity and allowing people to thrive and prosper?
Yes, receiving a just wage, again, to provide for their families and to contribute to the society and to build up the common good.
I want to ask you about a quote from someone who worked with you in San Diego, Rabbi Lori Cosby, who worked with you. She's the director of the Interfaith Committee for Worker Justice. And on this issue, she said, "We worked together on a living wage, but at the same time, we worked against each other on various social issues. But he was thoughtful in being able to work in coalition with people who might see the world differently." Is that something that you think is important to be able to do, no matter whether or not you are on different sides of different issues?
Oh, absolutely. I always try to find areas of commonality in order to work side by side with others on issues of common concern, even though we might be divergent on other issues, to not let that get in the way of good in other areas that we could accomplish together and to try to focus on that.
So that brings me, not surprisingly, to the question then of something like gay marriage. Because again, for many people, that's a question of diversity, a question of human rights, a question of allowing people to be fully themselves. Where do you make that distinction of championing the rights of immigrants, the rights of workers, but being so firmly opposed to the question of gay marriage?
I would prefer to begin by what I'm in favor of, not what I'm opposed to. Anyone who's in favor of something is opposed to its opposite. What I'm in favor of is preserving the traditional definition of marriage in the law. This discussion could go on for the rest of the hour and beyond, but I would point out just this morning I heard on this radio station the news report about concern for young men and boys of color who are dropping out of school, dropping out of society. We're losing them. And why is that happening and what can we do because we need them in the workforce? Again, I would look to human dignity even beyond their need in the workforce. They're human beings that have dignity and that needs to be affirmed. Certainly, it's a very complex problem and the solution will be multifaceted. But one of those facets has to be fathers. Fatherlessness is a big problem, a contributing factor to this. And we need to reclaim the importance of fathers, fathers being attached to their children and to the woman with whom we brought those children into being. Marriage is the only institution we have that connects children to their mothers and their fathers. If you believe children need a father, if you believe children need a mother, marriage is the only institution that's going to connect them to that. I don't see that as discriminatory toward anyone. It's not a judgment on how people live their intimate lives. It's something that benefits everyone to give children this opportunity.
Though some conservatives would argue, David Brooks, for example, I remember saying once that he was a conservative, therefore he supported gay marriage because he thought the institution of marriage itself was foundational and was a way in which we could preserve the family.
It really gets down to what your idea of marriage is, doesn't it? Is marriage about children or not? Is marriage about connecting children to their mothers and fathers? Is that important? If it is, we will be for marriage as it's always been understood. Anything else, for those of us who understand marriage this way as it's always been understood, anything else is not marriage. It's something else. And why do we need to change that definition of marriage in the law? How much more will the definition change is another factor. That's why I say it's preserving the traditional definition of marriage in the law. So it's not just a ban on gay marriage. It's a ban on polygamy, polyandry, and polyamorous relationships that could be recognized as marriage.
But to draw the distinction between those examples, a married gay couple would argue, look, we're monogamous. We have a soul relationship. And we are bringing a child up in a loving way. And that child is better off in that circumstance than he or she might be if they were in a fatherless home, if they were in a foster home somewhere else.
The social science data is still outstanding on that. We know that the ideal for the child is to be raised by a mother and a father. And we should do everything we can to foster that. It's not discriminatory toward anyone. What really is the point of it? What really is the point of it if it's not for giving children the opportunity to grow up with their mother and their father? Judge Walker, in his decision overturning Proposition 8, stated it quite explicitly. It's about societal affirmation. I don't believe the purpose of the law is to affirm people. The law is to protect people's rights and to provide for the common good. So we need laws that would protect people from discrimination, from persecution. Again, that's an attack on their human dignity. But that's a separate question from what is the fundamental good for children and therefore for our society.
Again, as you say, we could spend our entire conversation about this, and I do want to get to a variety of other topics. But of course, within the trial, there apparently wasn't evidence suggesting that you said a moment ago the evidence was out, but apparently there isn't evidence at all, at least as so considered by the judge. I mean, when you say that it's not discriminatory, I'm curious to hear more about that because I think for many gay individuals, they wouldn't read it that way. When you say, your quote in your recent press conference was, "Our stand against gay marriage is not against anyone, but it is because we believe this is foundational to preserve our society." I think that at least many gay individuals will say, well, it is discriminatory because it means I can't do something I want to do. And I am doing something by raising a child that is foundational.
Let me tell you an anecdote. I've told this many times in talks I've given. Maybe some of the listeners have heard it. But it was when I, literally day one, when I went to Oakland for the announcement of my appointment there. One of the priests was giving me a – I wanted to see the city and especially the many inner city neighborhoods that are there. As we were driving through those neighborhoods, I saw – would every once in a while see a billboard that said, take time to be a father today. And typically it'd show an African-American man holding a baby in his arms. So I was very encouraged by that. Finally, there's a campaign to promote fatherhood. I was looking all around me. The fatherlessness has so much to do with the plight of those families in those inner city neighborhoods. At one point, we drove down a street. There was a public school. School was out, but there was a sign on the window facing out onto the street, vote no on Proposition 8. We got to the end of the block, and what did I see across the street? Take time to be a father today. You can't have it both ways. You can't say children need a father and then also need a mother. You know, that they need a father doesn't mean that they don't need a mother. You can't say a child needs a father and a mother and then be supportive of gay marriage. You can't have it both ways.
So from your point of view, a gay father can't be a father?
I'm not sure what kind of a circumstance you mean. Married to a woman, married to another man, as a single father?
I guess in any number of circumstances, as someone who adopts a child in any number of ways. I guess I'm not clear on why that individual can't be a father.
The individual can exercise a fatherly role, but when I was talking about fathers, I meant biological fathers who take responsibility for the children they bring into the world so that the child can have a father in his or her life. When that's not possible, the society tries to provide that by adoption, and adoption is a happy alternative when the biological parents are – it's not possible for the child to be raised by them. But adoption then mirrors the situation of how the child came into the world. Every child has a father and a mother. That's in the natural order. There's no other way for a child to be brought into the world than by the union of a man and a woman. And even with our modern technology, still every child has a father and a mother. One person smarter than I on this issue put it, that when a baby is born, the mother is sure to be somewhere nearby. There's no guarantee that the father will be nearby. Society needs a cultural mechanism to connect the father to the child and to the mother that with whom we brought the child into the world, and that cultural mechanism is marriage.
Let's go back to that street you were driving down and the signs that you saw, because part of where I want to go with this conversation is how you will come to San Francisco and fit your flock, so to speak. As you know, the majority of Catholics in America are supportive, for example, of abortion rights. That's even higher, I'm sure, in the city of San Francisco. How will you... Or does that matter? Do you have to – what efforts will you make, I guess, to fit with this particularly so famously liberal community on these particular issues? Or is the point that you don't fit and that it's important to sort of draw a line regardless of what zip code you reside in?
In some cases, yes, it's clear to draw a line on issues that are non-negotiable. But we just don't draw a line in the sand and stand there and wave our fingers. You know, we need to educate our people. Why do we believe this? Why do we teach this? What good is it really getting at? The church has been pondering these issues for 2,000 years. We do have a lot of wisdom to offer. So it's trying to break through the stereotypes and the rhetoric to get people to think and ponder seriously. So we do have – you're right. We have a huge challenge in educating our own people. But I think if we were more effective in doing that, they would – see the wisdom of our teaching.
So tell me how you're going to do that. I mean, here in San Francisco, how would you go about teaching what you want to teach? How will you go about reaching those who might say, I've heard where the bishop stands on these issues. He's not someone who is going to be receptive to me.
I'm not coming in with a preset plan. So I need to work with my collaborators here, who will be my new collaborators in the Archdiocese. There are the classic ways for a bishop to communicate with his flock through the media of the Archdiocese, the newspaper, the San Francisco Catholic, the website. There are a lot of special events I'm sure I'll be going to, visiting parishes and so forth. But a lot of it will be working with the priests and then the religious and lay people who are teaching in the parishes to work together with them. And when people say, I've heard the message and I won't be accepted, I would challenge them. Have you really listened to the message, and have you really pondered it?
Will you undertake any specific outreach efforts to gay Catholics in particular?
I will look for opportunities to do that, and some have already reached out to me. I certainly will want to have opportunities to do that.
How have they reached out to you? Where might that go?
Offering invitations to dialogue. I have had some dialogues in the past, and I'm open to doing that again.
I'm interested in exploring with you what can be questioned and what can't. You said a moment ago there are some issues that are so foundational that there is a line that can be drawn. Where are those? Where is questioning possible and where is it not? For example, on the question of abortion, is that something where there is no wiggle room?
One principle is that it can never be right to take an innocent human life. That's what abortion does. But we don't stop there. We also recognize the harm very often it does to the mother, and not just the mother, so many people who are affected by that decision, the father of the child, the parents of the woman, siblings. There's a whole circle of relationships of people who are affected by that decision. Very often what happens is the woman doesn't really want to go through with it, but she's given no support. I mean, what does that say about what we believe about the dignity of women? I've been a priest for 30 years, and women have told me that I didn't want to go through with it, but I felt like I had no choice. If we're supposed to be a pro-choice society, why is that choice not supported? So we don't look just at that. That is a line we draw in the sand, but we don't stop there. We look at how do we support women in this situation. And that's why we would favor policies that would give her support to make that choice and be able to bring that child into the world.
And is that also why, for you, there is complete moral consistency to opposing the death penalty?
The death penalty is a little different because it's not an intrinsic evil, although theoretically it's not. One of the big problems with the death penalty is if you make a mistake, then you do end up killing an innocent human being. But theoretically, it's not. I think with the death penalty, there are a lot of practical problems, such as if there is a mistake, there's no way to repair the injustice that's been done, how it adversely affects poor and minority people. You know, wealthy people don't get executed. And that it apparently does not serve as a deterrent. I don't see our society being any less violent because we have the death penalty. So I think for a lot of practical reasons and also because it promotes a better consistent ethic of life, which would be my principle that I would apply to these issues. It promotes a better ethic of life.
So on these fundamental life questions, to what extent can you be a Catholic and disagree? To what extent can you be a Catholic and say, I support abortion rights?
Well, I said one core principle is that it's never right to take an innocent human life. So that would be a non-negotiable. When it comes to capital punishment, this is where we need to use more persuasion. There is some room for differences of opinion there. But again, I think if people were to listen to the messages of the bishops in this country, of other countries as well, and of the last several popes, that they would begin to see the wisdom. But it's not one of those clearly defined non-negotiable issues.
Did you agree with, I believe it was the Archbishop of St. Louis, who said in 2004 that John Kerry should not be able to receive communion because of his stand on abortion rights? Would you concur with that? Would you concur with denying communion, for example, to one of your new parishioners, Nancy Pelosi, the minority leader of the House?
We have, this is another area where we need to do a lot of education for our own people about this the communion issue, that what is Holy Communion for Catholics? It's not simply a gesture of welcome or a gesture of belonging. It's one has to be in a proper disposition to receive the sacrament. We, in our theological language, we call it in a state of grace, free from serious sin. Anyone who would cooperate in a serious moral evil would be in a state of serious sin and would not be in a position to receive communion.
So,
if they're favoring laws that that are favorable toward abortion. Now, the teaching is that if a law is passed that would have the effect of reducing a grave intrinsic evil such as abortion, would have that effect, but still keep it legal, there would be a reason for being approving the law. But if it's for the sake of making abortion more available, it would have the effect of increasing it or make it readily available in favor of abortion as a right. That is a serious moral evil. And anyone who cooperates in that, such as working to pass such a law, should not receive communion.
Does that mean that Nancy Pelosi would not be welcome for communion at a service?
I'd prefer to have a discussion with her about that. I've never talked to her one-on-one. I have the impression from the media, but I'd rather talk one-on-one about that. But that's the principle.
And does that apply, Bishop, more generally to your not the powerful speaker or former speaker of the House, but just your average parishioner? If you are a Catholic, as many Catholics are, who take what's sometimes called the smorgasbord approach to Catholicism and believe in some dictates of the church and not others. Does that apply broadly if you're someone who is supportive of many things in the church, considers themselves a Catholic, but disagrees with what you were just saying about the question of abortion rights? Does that apply to that person? That person is also not welcome?
It applies to everyone. It's the consistent teaching of the church going back to St. Paul. Well, we see that in the writings of St. Paul about being properly disposed to receiving Holy Communion. Yes. That's why we have another sacrament to help people be properly disposed if they have need of that forgiveness.
And how finally then do you make those distinctions? Is that if you don't, for example, if you favor the death penalty, does that then that standard same apply?
Yeah, that's where it gets a little tricky. As I said, the death penalty, at least theoretically, isn't an intrinsic evil. I think someone who has seriously considered the teachings of the bishops on the issue and sees it as necessary as a legitimate self-defense on a societal level, it would be acceptable.
We'll hold it there and come back and continue our conversation with the new Archbishop of San Francisco, Salvatore Cordiglione. Much, much more to talk about in our conversation. We welcome your thoughts and questions as well for the Archbishop. You can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org, or you can post your questions or thoughts on our Facebook page or website. I'm Dave Iverson. This is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our guest this hour, the new Archbishop of the San Francisco Archdiocese, Salvatore Cordiglione. He joins us. We welcome your questions and thoughts for the Archbishop as well at 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or post your questions or thoughts on our website or Facebook page. We left off with this question of drawing lines and what is sort of fundamental and where there is sort of room for gray. And that brings me actually to ask you about this question of room for gray. And I want to do it within the context of a meeting that is going on now in St. Louis with the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, which is the organization that represents about 80% of the Catholic sisters. They've been taken to task by the Vatican for straying from doctrinal loyalty, I guess, would be the right way to say it. They say all they're doing is questioning, that they're not endorsing women in the priesthood. They're not taking a stand on gay marriage. They're just questioning. And Sister Pat Farrell, the leader of that organization, said, quote, questioning is seen as defiance. It's not healthy for the church. How do you view that basic question? Not so much of where they stand on issue X or Y, but just being able to ask questions.
Good question. First of all, this doctrinal investigation, as it's called, is of a leadership conference of the religious in these religious orders. It's not of any particular order. It's certainly not an indictment of all the wonderful work that sisters have done over the years. In fact, the letter from the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith affirms them for all the good work that they have done. So this is it's a conference of leaders, what we call the major superiors, the heads of the orders throughout the country. That's what's being investigated. And there are some concerns, especially with speakers they've had who speak about moving beyond the church, even moving beyond Jesus Christ. The teachings of the church that have been defined, those are our core principles. Now, I know a lot of Catholics are going to question them, struggle to understand them. I would hope that they would struggle to understand rather than just outright reject if they don't understand it. But what about people involved in leadership, people exercising ministry in the church? You know, I don't know of any organization that allows the leaders entrusted with advancing its mission to dissent from its core principles. I don't know why that is institutional suicide. So there are some issues where, yeah, we're still working out where do you draw the line in affirming human life on the death penalty case, as you brought up earlier. But we do have a body of defined teachings that are our core principles. The leaders of the church entrusted with advancing the mission of the church have to be on board with that. Otherwise, how can the Catholic Church, like any other organization, advance its mission?
But that sounds a bit like if you're a leader, you can't ask questions. If you're a member of the flock, you can.
Do you know any organization that allows its leaders to dissent from its core principles?
Well, I guess, and this gets into yet another difficult area, but it brings to mind, actually, what happened with some of the priest pedophile cases in the case in Philadelphia where Monsignor Lynn was found guilty of child endangerment. And the defense was essentially that he was just following orders, that he was following the leadership of his archbishop. And in the end, the judge says, you knew what was right and you chose wrong. So I guess the question would be that even for leaders, it's sometimes important to ask questions.
This is not questioning doctrine, though. This is questioning the governance of an archdiocese. Monsignor Lynn did, in fact, question. He tried to get some action on it, but when he was said about following orders, he was following orders from higher up, but he did try to get some action to address this problem. So I feel bad that he's bearing the brunt of the punishment now when he did try to get some movement on it. But there's an issue of prudential judgments and pastoral discretion and pastoral governance. That's different from questioning doctrine. Any organization that has leaders entrusted with this mission, the point is the leaders should feel conviction about what this organization believes and what its mission is. And if you have conviction, why would you be questioning core principles other than you might have a question about it and you want to try to understand it better, but not in a defiant sort of a way?
Just one more follow-up thought on that, and then we'll get to our listener calls. I guess the question would be, you said, what organization can prosper if its leadership has questions about its fundamental mission? And yet it would seem in some ways that questioning is essential to the health of an organization. And even in personal matters as well, the spiritual writer Kathleen Norris, I remember writing once that the opposite of faith isn't doubt. The opposite of faith is fear. And the doubt is important. The questioning is important.
There's even a line in the gospel, someone going to the Lord for asking help, saying, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. So I think doubt does have that positive dimension to it if we know how to use it positively to move us to question, to understand more deeply.
But only some things.
Well, for leaders, they should already be there.
Let's hear what our listeners are thinking. Mark in San Leandro starts us out. Mark, go ahead, please.
Hi, my name is Mark, and I'm calling about the bishop's stance on marriage, and he seems to say that the foundational principle of marriage is procreation. I happen to be a heterosexual in a heterosexual marriage for 22 years. Early on in our marriage, my wife and I decided we would not have children. According to then the bishop's stance, it seems to me that he would consider my marriage invalid. Perhaps he would need to advocate for a law that says that couples who marry and don't have children within 7 years, their marriages should be annulled because they have not met his foundational principle. How is my marriage and its goals and its purposes different from any gay marriage? Why would mine be valid and a gay person's not be valid, or is my marriage invalid according to his position? And I'll take my answer off here.
Mark, thanks.
Regarding the invalidity of the marriage, that's a religious judgment that would be done through church court, a tribunal. But the difference is the sexual complementarity is the pattern by which the children come into the world. It's not possible to have that sexual complementarity without a man and a woman.
And let's go next to our next caller, John, in Berkeley. John, go ahead.
Hi. So I have a question here, and I see an issue that I don't understand how exactly you can reconcile the idea that you can give wiggle room for a conservative politician who would be in favor of the death penalty, while condemning a liberal politician or any politician, I suppose, who would be in favor of a woman's right to choose. Well, I mean, it seems to me that that would be a profoundly hypocritical stance to take. And, I mean, perhaps you should also be condemning any politician who doesn't give support for a living wage. Perhaps you should also be condemning any politician who does not support full immigrant rights, as you say that you have support for. But the Catholic Church and the hierarchy of the Catholic Church has been pretty explicit and implicit in supporting conservative politicians who have a lot of positions that are very against the stated teachings of the church, with the exception of abortion. So how can you reconcile with that? And how can you give wiggle room to somebody who allows for capital punishment? I'm taking my comments off the air.
John, thanks.
I'll try to explain that again. But first of all, I'll point out that from the church perspective, we don't approach it politically. We approach it from, again, what affirms human dignity and a consistent ethic of life. We don't have an absolute standard on all the social issues. We have some basic principles, one of which is that it's never right to take an innocent human life. Abortion takes an innocent human life. We speak about a woman's right to choose, but what is she choosing to do? And as I pointed out earlier, very often it's not a choice. She's in a position where she doesn't have the choice, the support to make the choice she would prefer to make.
And of course, it also depends on your definition of where life begins, and different religious traditions have different definitions.
Well, it's not a question. That's not a question for religion. It's a question for science. And it's very clear in science, life begins with fertilization, that we have, you have a new human being when that ovum is fertilized. So there's a non-negotiable. But we don't make everything a non-negotiable. There are basic principles that are non-negotiable. There are public policy positions, and we also don't endorse or condemn any politicians. If there are matters of their practice of their faith, then we might have to address that in terms of whether or not they're in a position to receive communion or to exercise ministry in the church and those sorts of things. But those are matters affecting the church. We don't take public stance. We're not allowed to anyway, and if we were, we wouldn't, for or against candidates. We do take public stands for or against certain policies. Some policies we favor because we believe they contribute better to the common good and are more respectful of human dignity. That doesn't mean that every policy position we take is a non-negotiable.
Just to get to John's point, I think where he's going with this is, and it sounds like you're saying the answer is yes, that some issues trump others, that it could be possible to be someone who is opposed to nuclear arms negotiations, supports the death penalty, opposes immigrant rights, but also opposes abortion, that's okay, but the converse wouldn't be.
I would say, how are they in favor of the death penalty, for example? Is it out of a sense of vindication? You know, there are some people that are, they cheer when there's someone executed. That's seriously wrong.
Yeah.
No, those people I don't think are properly disposed. But if it's because they honestly believe society needs this to protect itself, that's a different question. That's where you're getting into some gray area. I'm opposed to the capital punishment, period. I don't think the society needs it to protect itself. And I would hope that someone who has that position would continue to ponder. But because it's not theoretically an intrinsic evil, there is some room for differences of opinion there.
How would you apply the concept of evil to what went on with all of the cases of pedophilia? The judge in the Philadelphia case referred to the priests involved as monsters in clerical garb. Could you not make the argument that that too is evil, that that too in a sense is taking innocent life?
In a sense, yes. Oh, it's obviously evil. Yeah, we've borne a lot of shame because of that. It's a very deep betrayal, especially by, you know, a member of the clergy who, in the eyes of children and young people, represent God, represent the authority of the church. That's a very deep betrayal. We've suffered a lot of shame. The studies that we've done show that it's, you know, it started to increase in the 60s, peaked in the 70s, and started to decrease in the 80s, then much more so in the 90s when bishops were beginning to take more decisive action. It sort of follows the pattern of what was going on in society at the time with the social revolutions in the 60s, the sexual liberation movements and all of that. To me, it's a lesson about how careful we have to be in the church not to get swept up into social movements, but to step back, ponder, reflect, judge according to our moral principles and our teaching tradition, to make judgments about what might be good in a social movement and what might be wrong and needs to be corrected.
But is it really more about, it sounds like you're saying it was part of what was going on in the 60s and 70s, though I'm not aware, perhaps there was a rise in pedophilia generally in the 60s and 70s, but as opposed to the responsibility of the church to not really take full responsibility and deal honestly with those priests who are engaging in that conduct.
Excuse me if I didn't convey myself correctly. I didn't mean to say there was an increase in pedophilia in the 60s and 70s, but there was much more. There was a relaxed sexual ethic. And I think the relaxed sexual ethic was something got into the mentality in society and including people in the church that was sort of let their guard down. I remember growing up in that era and, you know, people criticizing how strict the church was with regard to sexual ethics. So there was this relaxation. And a lot of these cases, the vast majority, were not technically not pedophilia. They were adolescents. So it was kind of blending in with this sort of relaxed attitude toward sexual matters. And
But I want to make sure I understand you clearly and to give you an opportunity to speak to the church's responsibility in those. I mean, adolescents are still children. So you're not suggesting, are you, that the church should be absolved of responsibility
I'm criticizing the church for not being more vigilant at that time.
All right. More of our callers. David in San Francisco is next. David, go ahead.
Good morning. I'm a physician, and the first thing the cardinal needs to do is read an eighth-grade biology book, A Fertilized
Archbishop,
Cell.
Actually, not cardinal,
Archbishop,
but go ahead.
Sorry. Fertilized egg is not a human being. It's an embryo. So he may want to check a volume out. Secondly, sitting here listening to his morally questionable assertion that the church somehow was impacted by the 60s. The only impact the 60s had is that people were able to open their eyes and see things that had been going on for years. And rather than step up and acknowledge the endemic nature of it, he still continues to wiggle around. Finally, his statement that he's not political is laughable. If he had spent one half the effort he did trying to defeat a fair marriage amendment in chasing down the pedophilia, and by the way, Archbishop, touching adolescents is pedophilia. he would be on a much sounder ground. I pity him, and I pity the people who have to put up with him.
David, thanks for your comment. The political point of David's comment, though, is I think, deserving of a response from you about when you were saying the church isn't political, and yet you did play a very, very active role in support of Proposition 8, the proposition to ban gay marriage.
I didn't say the church isn't political. I said the church doesn't take positions on candidates. The church does take positions sometimes on policy and legislation.
So
that's a part of being involved in public life. You know, if the church is going to play a role in public life, like any other organization, labor unions, professional organizations, they all have matters of legislation that are of interest to them. Those that are of interest to us is what we believe is going to contribute to the common good. So why should we not be allowed to be involved? Again, in the area of policy and legislation, not officially endorsing or opposing candidates.
Lots and lots of emails, not surprisingly, coming in on the question of gay marriage, and I won't read them all. Suffice it to say that there are many, many, mostly, of course, you won't be surprised, challenging your views on this. So I will read one. Chris writes, for many years, society considered that in a traditional marriage, the wife was the property of her husband. That is no longer a societal norm. It is time to change our definition of traditional marriage.
Well, to what? What's the next step to changing it? What is essential to marriage is really what the question gets down to. If it's going to be, if you don't need a man and a woman, well, why do you need two people then for it to be a marriage?
Well, I think that speaks
to...
continue
to redefine it until essentially you redefine it out of existence.
Well, I understand the slippery slope argument that you're making, but I think a lot of people would come back to that and say, we're talking about a monogamous, loving relationship between two people who happen to be of the same sex, and that is fundamental to the way in which our society can work because it builds in a concept of stability and love that is important to how we exist. What can be wrong with that?
We're talking about that today. If the purpose of marriage is not to attach children to their mothers and their fathers, then what is the purpose of marriage?
Well, I think
what is the public interest in marriage?
I think our earlier caller made the point that you can have a loving relationship between and a lasting marriage between a man and a woman where children are not involved.
But what is the public interest in that? If it's not about trying to provide the best context for children to grow up in.
To our next caller, Sally in San Francisco. Sally, go ahead.
Hi. I have a little problem with the idea that the Archbishop feels that life begins at conception when 30 to 35% of the fertilized ovums are spontaneously aborted in the first trimester. And it flies against reason that a loving God would create these souls so they could be expelled before they ever experienced life.
Sally, thank you.
Well, there's a scientific question and a theological question. As far as the scientific question goes, scientific journals up until recently always acknowledged that human life begins at conception. Now there's been a rethinking of that it begins at implantation or at some other stage. But it was always recognized in the scientific community up until recently that it begins at conception.
Though we've heard, obviously, from many people, including the doctor who called earlier, who has a different definition.
Well, more recently, there different definitions have been proposed, but it's curious that we're at a very convenient time in history for different definitions to be proposed.
But to our caller's most recent question, to Sally's question, she's saying if what God would allow that, you know, if you take your point of view, how could God allow one third of all fertilized eggs to disappear?
We're getting into the theological question here.
That's okay.
Yeah, okay. I can talk about theology. I'm not going to give a satisfactory answer to that. It is a mystery that we cannot reply to satisfactorily. But We do know that our Catholic belief is that God created the world good, but it's flawed because of human sin. There's this defect in the order that God originally created, and that's why he had to send us a Savior to redeem us from that. So the way the evil works out, grief, suffering, all that is worked out in God's plan through the merits of his Son, Jesus Christ, who died on the cross for us.
Sally, thanks for raising the question and for your call. Colin in San Francisco is next. Colin, you're on.
Good morning. Archbishop, if a priest in your jurisdiction had raped and impregnated an underage parishioner, would you oppose the victim's decision to have an abortion as the taking of a human life? Shouldn't there be an exception made in that case?
Well, another basic principle is you cannot do evil to accomplish a good. I think a girl in that situation needs a lot of love and a lot of support. I really don't believe that that decision is going to affirm her dignity and help her experience love and compassion, besides the fact that it is taking another innocent life. That's a horrendous thing to happen. But I don't think that is the adequate response to reach out to her.
Is it the position of the church that there be no rape exemption to the question of abortion?
It's taking an innocent human life, and no.
To Greg in Oakland. Greg, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. My question is pretty simple, which is why does a religious order need to enforce its rules on society at large when its own congregation should be following those laws already?
Greg, thanks. So the question would be, why push the Catholic point of view on something like gay marriage?
We're not pushing our doctrine. We're pushing what is things that apply, well, in our Catholic way of looking at it, we call it the natural law, what already exists out in nature, public policy issues. These are not matters of, we have beliefs that we believe have been revealed to us by God, about our belief about the Holy Communion, for example, we were talking about earlier, what that means. We're not asking that this be recognized in the law. We're looking at matters that do not depend on religious definitions, but on matters that pertain to justice and human dignity.
Let's get in one more question. Jane, you're it. Corte Madera, go ahead.
I have two questions, if I may. Number one, what about in vitro fertilization? Now, there's no union of a man and a woman raising that child in all situations. What about a woman who is pregnant and her husband is killed in an accident? She has to go out and get married right away, so there'll be a father present for that child that's going to be born. And also, if your definition of life is when an egg and a sperm join, what about until that time, why can't your parishioners use contraception to prevent that union?
Okay, Jane, thank you. Lots of questions. Why don't you take the last one on contraception, if you would?
Looking at the natural order, we believe, and I believe it's apparent in the natural order, the purpose of that union is for procreation and to unite the man and the woman to each other. That anything that would frustrate that or work against it, especially introducing anything artificial into it, distorts it from its true purpose for which God created it.
So much more I wish we had time to discuss, but we just have a few moments more. So let me get to at least one other issue that has not come up yet, and that is on the minds of many people. And that has to do with the ordination of women. Where do you stand on that issue? Is that an area at all where you see possibilities, where you see questioning? Or is that, again, one of these for which there is a foundational line which cannot be crossed?
Well, this requires a theology lesson that I don't think I can do in 2 minutes, but it depends on what is happening at the altar when the priest is at the altar. Is he simply fulfilling religious functions to provide religious services to his people? In which case, yes, women would be capable of doing that. This has nothing to do with thinking women are inferior. But if he is to be the image of Jesus Christ, who's, it's very appropriate we're talking about marriage on this show, who is the bridegroom of the church and the church who is the bride, it's all the nuptial imagery. Scripture is replete with nuptial imagery. Our Christian liturgy is replete with that nuptial imagery. God's covenant with the people of Israel was a marriage covenant. And as Christians, we believe that sealed in the blood of Jesus Christ, who's the bridegroom of the church. Only a man can be a bridegroom. because of his male body. The image of the church is that of the bride who receives the seed of life from her bridegroom and begets new children for God's kingdom through the sacraments and through the teaching of the church. There's a lot more to say. It's pretty deep theology, but it all gets down to the nuptial imagery.
And one last, just briefly, you have so many challenges in front of you, so many diverse questions, so much contention in many ways. I want to ask you last, just very briefly, how you'll go about the healing part of what you do, about bringing people together in a time when there is such divergent view.
We're going to need to listen a lot to each other. And again, as I mentioned before, I hope we could focus on issues that we do share in common. And I think the more we get to know each other, not just base judgments according to stereotypes or perceptions through the media, but get to know each other as human beings. Rabbi Kosky is a very good example. She's such a wonderful person, and I always enjoyed being in her company. Now, we were, you know, against each other on some of these critical issues, but because we had a human relationship, we were able to work together on other issues.
Best of luck, Archbishop, in making those human relations work in the future.
Thank you very much, David.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Tina Lorberg. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Howard Gelman has been our engineer today. Raul Ramirez, our executive producer. I'm Dave Iverson, in for Michael Krasny. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.